Hey, I want to tell you about something that when I came to this text today, I came with kind of a reluctance. In one sense, it's pastors, preachers would say it's one of the favorite people to talk about and text to preach from. And in one sense, it is all of that. But as I do every single week, I preach to myself first. So you're not getting something that didn't go through me first. And I have a son. And it happens to be, it would feel the same if I only had a daughter. As it turns out, we have a son and two daughters. But as a parent, I relate to this story only for a while. And then I just lose my way. It's why the cross is so huge for me, is because I think of what God the Father did there on that cross, and I think, I guarantee you, the whole human race would have been extinct at that point, because I couldn't do that. I just could not let my son do what God and the Father and Son did in Calvary. My title is really a very personal and very real title, When Faith is Tested. And I take that from both Hebrews 11 and Genesis 22, and you'll see both places in a moment, because you're going to understand the very nature, the true core issue when it comes to the Abraham-Isaac story. It is an epic test of Abraham's faith. Make no mistake about it, if you leave here with nothing else, the truth you need to have anchored in your heart is God will test your faith. No doubt about that. And I don't know about you, if you go back to high school or college or grad school, but I did right away. When I hear the word test, I kind of twitch, because I hate tests. You know what I'm talking about? I just don't like the true false multiple choice kind of test. So not every test, because there are tests that frankly were my salvation going through 9 years of post high school education. Essay tests are my best friend. Now some of you are going, that makes sense, because you like to gab, don't you? You like to talk. And I do like to talk, and writing comes easy for me. So whenever a professor, and I should tell you, both of my grad programs were very heavily weighted toward essay. So when the teacher said, hey, we got an exam coming up, bring one or two or more blue books. Everybody know what a blue book is? I was thrilled. Man, I had, and sure enough, I just wordsmithed my way through college and my first master's and second master's, and went, that was easy. And thankfully, they didn't have multiple choice or true-false, because they would probably, it would reveal how little I knew. But anyway, okay, so that's enough. I don't like tests. So I see that word, it's my word, on the screen behind me, but it's in the Bible. I didn't create the word. And if you're not in Hebrews 11, find your way to verse 17 right now, and you'll see with your own eyes a label God gives what happened there. When it comes to our study, then, I get nervous. Words like those that we're going to read here, introducing today's hero, which is Abraham, our third week with him, by the way, they make me wince. So verse 17, by faith Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. Let me just stop for a second. By faith Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. I care not who you are. If you take even a moment to be honest about that statement, it makes you shudder, does it not? Take it in. Don't read it like you've read it 1,000 times before, like I have. Stop and take that in, and it should make you shudder. And if it doesn't, consider tweaking the word slightly. and it is guaranteed to cause you a disturbance. By faith, Steve, when God tested him, finished the sentence. Put your name in there, though. It doesn't. You don't need to hear about me. How do you hold up when tested by God? That's the question. Do you get stuck on questions like, why me? And if we had a show of hands, mine would be up in the air. That's something that goes through my mind. What did I do, God? Why me? If so, you wouldn't be the first to feel that way. Theologian R.C. Sproul was asked the question, why do bad things happen to good people? How many have ever asked that question or thought of that question or heard it asked? Everybody, right? His answer is the best I've ever heard. Why do bad things happen to good people? His answer, I haven't met any good people yet, so I don't know. There we go. And he wasn't taking a shot at somebody he knew. He was talking about the human condition, according to Psalm 14, Psalm 53, and Romans 3. Read it and you will agree with him. Holy smokes. There are none good. And I'm not the exception to that. Neither are you. So, that said, I'll go out on a limb. Abraham was pretty darn close. Would you be okay with that? None good, Sproul says. None righteous, the Bible says. But the preacher is saying Abraham was pretty close. So let's learn what God has for us to learn when our faith's tested. Now let's read on. Verse 17, by faith Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had embraced the promise was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, it is through this son, Isaac, that your offspring will be reckoned. Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead. And so, in a matter of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from the dead. It's all that's written about it right here in Hebrews. As we do each time, we're going to go back. Genesis 22, you can go there now, but we'll go there in a couple of minutes. But let's remember what we've learned already about Abraham and Isaac, okay? They were childless for a very, very long time. That we've covered that in detail. And they were well into their twilight years before they learn the shocking, they're told of God's surprising, humanly impossible plan to give them a child, he at 99 years of age and she at 89 years of age. That's what we know. They conceived, and to use the words of Proverbs 13:12 that Debbie and I used after 5 years of infertility, hope deferred makes the heart sick is the first part of Proverbs 13:12. That's why we memorized it, because it described us well. But desire fulfilled, it concludes, is the tree of life. It's an image of abundance. It's an image of fruitfulness and bounty. And they were living that. You see, God, who, as we've established up to this point, with Abraham and Isaac, demonstrated that he cares a great deal about our faith. Not quantity of faith, but quality of faith. Digest that for a sec. It's not the abundance of faith, otherwise words that Jesus says in Matthew 17, for example, verse 20. Truly I tell you, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, think of our mountain, Mount Hood. You can say to Mount Hood, get up and move south 100 miles, or go east 1,000 miles, and it'll be done. If you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you could pull that miracle off. But it's not quantity. It's quality of faith. To repeat, God places a high priority on faith. If you did a word search of the word itself, faith, you'd find it over 500 times in the Bible. That's way up there in numbers of mentions of the word. It'd be like, listen to your family through the eyes of a child, or maybe when your kids are young adults like ours are, listen to how they describe life growing up in your home. And you'll hear repeated words, fun stuff, hopefully, but not all fun. And if you were to sit around the campfire with God and talk about growing up around God's truth, you would hear others say, I hear a lot about faith. There was all kinds of mention about faith, that he wants faith in his people, that he requires faith of his people, and he will refine it in order to make his people's faith pure. So, let's pull back the curtain, and to do so, Genesis 22 is where the story is told. And I'll just tell this because it sometimes we only read it in a sort of a one-dimensional form. I want you to imagine hearing Abraham or being Abraham hearing these things firsthand, okay? So Abraham's just kind of settling into life in Beersheba, which is kind of due west of the southern tip of the Dead Sea. It's 30 miles south of Jerusalem. It's more than that, 60 miles south of Jerusalem. That's kind of roughly where it is. He's kind of there getting settled in and got a son, long-promised son. He and his wife are going, pinch me. That's what's going on here. Okay, we're living the dream. We can't even believe. We dreamt that long for this, but it's now ours and it's happening. And then verse 1, sometime later, God tested Abraham. So we've read that twice now, back in Hebrews 11, 17, and now 22, 1 in Genesis. He said to Abraham, here I am. He said to him, Abraham, here I am, came Abraham's reply. Then God said, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain that I will show you. All right, let's stop the story for a minute. Those are the words he heard. God's words of testing. Abraham hears from heaven what amounts to an all-encompassing, put it on the line, no holds barred, winner take all test. No other way to hear verse 2. You're to sacrifice your son that you have waited for a lifetime to welcome into your family. And so we don't miss anything he tells us about Abraham's affection for his son. The son whom you love, we're told in verse 2. Horrible words if you're Abraham. Words that you say, how can this be true? Difficult to imagine how hard and how horrible this test was for Abraham. And I have to tell you, I could find no evidence of this. Let me say it in the reverse. There was no guarantee that he would go through with it. Let me ask it this way. If he refused, now what? You're there that day, out in the yard, doing something, and you hear words like that from God. Like Abraham, heard. You say, no, no, I'm going to reject that test, essentially. I can't do that, God. What are the results? I don't know. My personal experience, thankfully it hasn't been of this, you know, magnitude, is God brings that test around again sometime later. God stretches me in another situation. Does it more or less say, look, you said no last time, you pushed back, you resisted, we've got to go there still. Because there's things I got to do in you there. And they only come through a severe test like this. But get this, one thing is clear. He did not run. He did not hide. He did not refuse. There's absolutely no indication of pushback. No resistance of any kind is recorded in Abraham. Verse 3. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place that God told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you." So we read here that Abraham went forward with the test. We're told it was early the next morning, and I think the reason for that is obvious. You don't sleep the night before a test of this size. You just don't. And he embarks on a 72-hour trek of tears. Through some research, I learned it's about 60 miles north of where they live. And it was estimated that, especially when you read words on the third day, that he looks up and sees the place he's told to go, Mount Moriah, that it's roughly a 20-mile-a-day journey from Beersheba to Moriah. So when I walk, I have a little a watch that tells me how much, and every so often I'll actually reach my goal, you know, like I did once last month and then yesterday because I had too much turkey and stuff like that. So, but it tells me, you know, you hit your 10,000 steps. What's that, 2 miles? Is that 5 miles? Really? Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Well, mine vibrates when that happens. And you ought to be around me when it happens. I'm like, yes! Now I'll really make that exclamation. Yeah! Because it's 5 miles. I thought it was two. But anyway, this is an exhausting three-day journey. They walked and walked and walked. And on the third day, we're told, verse 4, that their destination is now in sight. And the horror of what was to take place on that hill up to this point, we have no other indication otherwise, is only known by Abraham. I can't imagine the physical strain of that journey. But on top of that, to bear a burden like this all those days, hours, probably for him, they were reduced to seconds. He kept staring at his son as they journeyed north. Maybe making Isaac uncomfortable. Dad, what's up with you? I don't know. They didn't talk like that back then. This is weird. You keep staring at me. And then he sees this scene that only he knows about. And I'm guessing at this moment, my sort of entry into the story is anywhere near accurate. His heart just about stopped. Instead of the joy of a journey that ended in the destination intended, this is like, why couldn't we keep walking for another 50 years? And it's likely nothing was said. Nothing's recorded on the journey at all. But what comes up next in verse 5 and following? What little is said says a lot. So look at verse 5 and see if you don't agree. He said to his servants, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then we will come back to you. Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac. And he himself carried the fire and the knife. The irony are amazing. You're carrying the wood that will consume your body. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father, Abraham, Father, yes, my son. Abraham replied, the fire and wood are here, Isaac said, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? He knew about offerings. Where is it? His dad answered, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And the two of them went on together. Let me interrupt and have us think respectfully as we reflect a little bit on a couple of comments that were just made. Abraham apparently had confidence that God would make a way. Verse 5 gives us a hint of that. We will worship and then we will come back to you. Can make a lot about that statement or very little. Was that a confidence in Abraham coming through? I tend to think so. Was it a certainty? I'm absolutely convinced it was not. More on that in a moment. But verse 8 is another interesting statement. God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So Abraham didn't know how, but he believed that God would. Probably a fairly safe statement to make, wouldn't you agree? Didn't know how, but he believed that God would. And his assumption was that God would provide some other means. That's what verse 8 is getting at. God will provide a lamb. Could have been figurative. You may be the lamb, son. I don't know. That's too much in my head. That's not down here in my heart at all. It's not a coin toss at all. That's not what we're talking about. Because still hidden in his soul, you back up to verse 2, are the piercing words, take your son, your only son whom you love, and sacrifice him as a burnt offering on a mountain that I will show you. Raising the very real possibility in Abraham's mind that there may in fact, be no other means. Which leaves us with only one option. That Abraham actually believed, had faith that God would raise his son, once sacrificed, from the dead. That seems to be, if we go back to chapter 11, verse 19, we already read it, but I'll just refresh your memory. The words in verse 19 of Hebrews 11 that say, Abraham reasoned that God could even raise the dead, and so in a matter of speaking, he did receive Isaac back from the dead. Isaac may die, but Abraham somehow inside his mind and heart had this confidence that God could even raise a deceased son from the dead. That's the only way, I think, to make sense out of the words that follow in verse 9. Pick up with me, would you? When they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. And I, if there's ever a place I long for more detail, it's in what comes next. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar. I don't know how that happened. I would think most sons would run for their lives. He didn't have help. Remember, they went alone. So he binds Isaac and lays him on top of the wood. This is not going well. And then he reaches out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. All the details are coming into focus if you're Isaac at this point. But then verse 11, some of the most glorious interruptions you'll ever find. The angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." You and I pick up a single exclamation point. It is a thunderous voice from heaven itself. It is so intense, it would have made you, if you've been around a sonic boom, when I was a kid, they were still breaking the sound barrier. Sound barrier, is that right? Yeah. And there would be a sudden, you know, like, it got your attention. You're paying attention now. "Abraham, Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. "Do not lay a hand on the boy," came the voice. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." Wow. Please do not make a mistake that's very tempting to make of thinking that somehow Abraham knew that if he went through with it, God would raise his son from the dead. In other words, he was without hesitation in motion when God... I think that's a terrible mistake. Raising from the dead had never happened up to this point in the Bible. Did you know that? In fact, there are only 10 recorded raisings from the dead in all of the Bible, and the very first one ever recorded is all the way into 1 Kings 17 involving Elijah and the widow's son. Do the math, that's 1,200 years yet in the future from this scene in Genesis 22. Which means Abraham couldn't say to himself in simple logic, "Well, I've seen you do this before, God. Maybe that's what you got up your sleeve in my case." Not true, not even close. It's a concept that is completely foreign to believe that was about to happen. Totally uncharted waters that required radical faith by Abraham. And that is why it's called a test. How far will you go trusting God? From Abraham's point of view, the outcome was anything but certain. So, how did he do? Verse 12, "Do not lay a hand on the boy," he is told. "Do not do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." He persevered in this horrible moment, and he passed the test. God did provide, and that became the place, actually became permanently named Provide. Will you look down and see it with your own eyes? We're at verse 12, actually a little bit later, verse 13. "Abraham looked up, and there in a thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son." What a cool phrase. "Not my boy. Instead of my child." So Abraham called that place, "The Lord will provide." And to this day it is said, on that mountain, the Lord provided. Yahweh Yireh. The Lord will provide. He will see to it, is what the Hebrew rendering is. Sounds like literally. On this mountain where God saw to it that there was a way around the sacrifice of Isaac, Abraham's son. That place has been permanently marked as Yahweh Yireh. God will provide. What will he provide? Can we bring that to us now for a few minutes? What do you need to have God provide you? Is it peace? Is it clarity? Provision? Okay, so you cover it all. Thanks, Alberta. So I made a list of things. Is it resolution? You're in a situation that's not resolved. Yahweh Yireh says, I will provide. Can't say when. You and I can never know when. Can we? And it goes on. You may need work. You may need him to provide you friends. You're lonely. Hope is probably the biggest one of all, isn't it? When I think of things that we can't live very long without, hope would be probably at the top of any of our lists. We need all of those things and much, much more. What do you need for God to provide you in this time of testing is really the takeaway, at least of verse 14, verse 13. Yahweh, he will provide. So, true to form, God goes way beyond provision. And that's what the story ends with, verse 15 and following. Just simply tells about how Abraham received big blessing from God as a result of him believing in God. Just look at it and enjoy it. The angel of the Lord called out to Abraham now a second time from heaven. And he said, I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you, and I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky. That's a repeat in case it had slipped from his memory back in chapter 12, chapter 15, chapter 17, and now 22, all from God to Abraham. I'm going to make a great nation, nations of the world. It turns out those are people of faith around the world will trace their roots to your faith, Abraham. I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring, look at this language, it's so cool, all nations on earth will be blessed because you, Abraham, have obeyed me. And then Abraham returned to his servants, and they set off together for Beersheba. And Abraham stayed in Beersheba. They returned home. I would have loved to hear the conversation on the way back. I don't know how much they talked about it, but if you've had a powerful experience with God, a God provision, a rescue from heaven, you can't stop talking about it. Wouldn't you agree? I don't know. We're not told that. But I kind of guess the servants are like, nah, no. Seriously? And I'll bet there's a lot of winking going on, father to son. It's our story. It's our story. God did this. I don't know all the ways that he was impacted, but they had to be many. Hey, before we leave this Mount Moriah, where all this took place, let me ask you a question. Have you ever wondered about God? Questions like, what are you up to? Here's one that comes right out of this story. And I thought of C.S. Lewis in the Chronicles of Narnia. Is God safe to you? Lewis addressed that. Remember Aslan, great lion? He's God in the story. And these are his words. He describes, he's asked the question, is God safe? Safe? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good. He's the king, I tell you. You'll go places you can't imagine going walking with God. Your faith will be tested beyond anything you can possibly come up with when you walk with God. That's going to happen. Two New Testament leaders of the early church. It's a baby church. It's not established. It has very little history. two of them weighed in on this whole idea of God being up to something, God doing something, and it involves a test. One's a half-brother of Jesus. His name's James. The other is Peter, an unlikely person. But he and James and some others, just a few, were who God used to do, to create Grace Point. Can I say it that way? Big deal stuff. These are some of their comments when it came. There's incredibly attractive words, and I don't have them on the screen. I just want you to take them in and listen to them. The first is from James. You're expecting me to quote James 1, 2 to 4. Consider it pure joy when you encounter various trials. I think it's on the header that I put at the outline at the top. When you encounter various trials, treat them as friends, not enemies. There's your assignment this week. When a trial comes your way, say, hey, welcome, come on in. Double dog dare you to do that, okay? Because that's where this goes, right? But a little later in James 1, verse 12, these really attractive words. Blessed is the one who perseveres under trial, because having stood the test, that person will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him. Isn't that beautiful? Stood the test. Strong in a hurricane. The wind will blow like crazy. And you're still standing. You pass the test. Peter was the other one I mentioned. These are so cool. So be truly glad, 1 Peter 1, verses 6 and 7. Be truly glad. There is wonderful joy ahead. Even though you must endure many trials for a little while, these trials will show that your faith is truly genuine. It is being tested as fire tests and purifies gold. Though your faith is far more precious than mere gold. How's that for a contrast? Still not done. So when your faith remains strong through many trials, it will bring you much praise and glory and honor on the day Jesus Christ is revealed to the whole world. End quote. I have one parting question for you. In hearing this story and reading it and digesting it, did you sense a similarity with another father-son story in the Bible? Not coincidentally either. Here, a father, Abraham, takes his son to a mountain to sacrifice him, only in the last moment to be stopped from going through with it. 2,500 years later, another father sent his son to Calvary, a mountain just a few miles from Moriah. Only in his case, the sacrifice went through. Jesus died on a cross. The Bible cannot stop talking about that because it is our hope. It is our only hope. John 3:16 says, God so loved the world that he gave his only son on Calvary. He went through with the sacrifice that whoever believes in Jesus Christ will not perish for their sins, the deserved judgment they had coming. But that judgment was taken out on his son. And in exchange, you are given eternal life. Isaiah was right when he described that. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. And the punishment that brought us peace was upon Jesus. I'd like you to bow your heads this morning. And open your heart as wide as you can right now in response to what you've just heard. Everything about it is as true as I've been able to determine. Abraham, his son Isaac, the very last moment, a miraculous intervention took place. And all sorts of lessons are yours and mine to take away. When you go through the test or are going through that test, or somebody you know and love is going through that test, you have a chance to just talk to them about the truth that God has talked to you about this morning. You realize that that's the intention of this? It's not a story that ends with you or me. It's meant to be part of our message to our children and our grandchildren and our neighbors and people that we know at work and everywhere else we live, at school and on, who are going through huge testing. We get to tell them about a God that does great things in times of testing. He's a provider God. But if that's all we give people, we haven't given them the thing they need the most. And this is love, not that we love God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to become the atoning, substitutionary sacrifice for our sin. That's the message that will change people for eternity. They won't just weather the storm they're in now. They will be standing when the end of this world and their lives come. If you're not clear about that gospel, that's what you've just heard, I urge you to respond to Jesus today. And if you have a family member or a friend or somebody that has never responded to Jesus, tell them about Abraham and Isaac. Then tell them about the Father and the Son and what He did for them. God, we come to you right now grateful. This has been a stirring study for me personally. And I pray that as you do deep things in our hearts from this point forward, you never let us drift from the central core truth that you loved us and delivered your Son up for us. And I pray that as a result of that, every day, in every way, our lives would be focused on you. We're going to respond in song and in giving. Would you join me in standing at this time? And by standing, you're saying, God, I'm going to ask you to move me forward from here. Strong in the fire and in the test, and clear about the gospel.